until almost too late, but the Chaos Legion had gotten the other pilot. That was why broomsticks usually didn't attack before armies met. It meant a whole army would concentrate fire on the broomstick.
And the dragons didn't even get anyone, did they?
Nope,
Tracy Davis said proudly. She, too, was now marching by General Potter's side, her wand gripped low and watchful as her eyes scanned the surrounding forest.
I threw up a prismatic sphere like a split second before Mr. Goyle's hex got Sabini, and the way Mr. Goyle had his other arm stretched out, I think he planned to knock down the General, too.
The Slytherin witch smiled with vicious confidence.
Mr. Goyle tried a breaking drill hex, but learned to his dismay that his weak magic was no match for my new-found dark powers.
Some Chaotix laughed with her, but a queasy sensation was starting in Neville's stomach as he realized how close the Chaos Legion had come to complete disaster. If Mr. Goyle had managed to disrupt both transfigurations...
Report!
Snapped the Dragon General, doing his best to conceal the fatigue he felt after casting 17 locking charms. With more yet to come. Beads of sweat now dotted Gregory's forehead.
The enemy got Dylan Vaughan,
Gregory said formally.
Harry Potter and Blaise Sabini were each transfiguring something dark grey and roundish. I don't think it was finished, but it looked like it would be big and hollow. It's all cauldron-shaped. Sabini's was smaller than Potter's. I couldn't get either of them to disrupt their transfigurations. Tracy Davis blocked me. Neville Longbottom's on a broomstick, and he's still a terrible flyer, but his aim is really good.
Draco listened, frowning, and then he glanced at Padma and Dean Thomas, who both shook their own heads, indicating that they also couldn't think of what might be big and grey and shaped like a cauldron.
"Anything else?" said Draco.
If that was it, they'd lost a broom for nothing.
"The only other weird thing I saw,"
Gregory said, sounding puzzled,
"was that some Chaotix were wearing... sort of like... goggles?"
Draco thought about this, not noticing that he'd stopped marching, or that all of Dragon Army had automatically stopped with him.
"Was there anything special about the goggles?"
Draco said.
Gregory said. "They were, greenish? Maybe?"
"Okay," said Draco. Again, without thinking, he began walking once more, and his dragons followed.
"Here's our new strategy. We're only going to send 11 dragons against the Chaos Legion, not 14. That should be enough to beat them, now that we can neutralize their special advantage."
It was a gamble, but you had to take gambles sometimes, if you wanted to come in first in a three-way battle.
"You figured out Chaos's plan, General Malfoy,"
said Mr. Thomas with considerable surprise.
"What are they doing?"
said Padma.
"I haven't the faintest idea,"
said Draco with a smirk of the most refined smugness.
"We'll just do the obvious thing."
Harry, having now finished his cauldron, was carefully scooping acorns into the container while the scouts searched for a nearby source of water that could be used as a liquid base. They'd come across frequent sinkholes and miniature creeks in the forest before, so it ought not to take long. Another scout had brought a straight stick that would serve as a stirrer, so that Harry didn't have to transfigure one. Sometimes, even though you were looking straight at something, you didn't realize what you were looking at until you happened to ask exactly the right question.
"How can I invoke magical powers that ought to be beyond the reach of first-year students?"
There was a cautionary tale the potions master had told them, with much sneers and laughter to make the stupidity seem low status instead of daring and romantic, about a second-year witch in Beaubaton, who stole some extremely restricted and expensive ingredients and tried to brew polyjuice so she could borrow the form of another girl for purposes better left unmentioned. Only, she had managed to contaminate the potion with cat hairs, and then, instead of seeking a healer immediately, the witch had hidden herself in a bathroom, hoping the effects would just wear off. And when she had finally been found, it had been too late to reverse the transformation completely, condemning her to a life of despair as a sort of cat-girl hybrid. Harry hadn't realized what that meant until the instant of thinking the right question. But what that implied was that a young wizard or witch could do things with potions making that they couldn't even come close to doing with charms. Polyjuice was one of the most potent potions known. But what made polyjuice an NEWT-level potion, apparently, wasn't the required age before you had enough magical power. It was how difficult the potion was to brew precisely, and what happened to you if you screwed up. Nobody in any army had tried brewing any potions up until then. But Professor Quirrell would let you get away with nearly anything if it was something you could also have done in a real war. "Cheating is technique," the defense professor had once lectured them. "Or rather, cheating is what the losers call technique, and will be worth extra Quirrell points when executed successfully." In principle, there was nothing unrealistic about transfiguring a couple of cauldrons and brewing potions out of whatever came to hand, if you had enough time before the armies met. So, Harry had retrieved his copy of Magical Drafts and Potions and begun looking for a safe but useful potion he could brew in the minutes before the battle started. A potion which would win the battle too fast for counterspells or produce spell effects too strong for first years to finite. Sometimes, even though you were looking straight at something, you didn't realize what you were looking at until you happened to ask exactly the right question. "What potion can I brew using only components gathered from an ordinary forest?" Every recipe in Magical Drafts and Potions used at least one ingredient from a magical plant or animal, which was unfortunate because all the magical plants and animals were in the Forbidden Forest, not the safer and lesser woods where battles were held. Someone else might have given up at that point. Harry had turned the pages from one recipe to another, skimming faster and faster in dawning realization, confirming what he had already read and was now seeing for the first time. Every single potion's recipe seemed to demand at least one magical ingredient. But why should that be true? Charms required no material components at all. You just said the words and waved your wand. Harry had been thinking about potions making as essentially analogous. Instead of your spoken syllables triggering a spell effect for no comprehensible reason, you collected a batch of disgusting ingredients and stirred four times clockwise, and that arbitrarily triggered a spell effect. In which case, given that most potions used ordinary components like porcupine quills or stewed slugs, you'd expect to see some potions using only ordinary components. But instead, every single recipe in Magical Drafts and Potions demanded at least one component from a magical plant or animal. An ingredient like silk from an acromantula, or petals from a Venus firetrap. Sometimes, even though you were looking straight at something, you didn't realize what you were looking at until you happened to ask exactly the right question.
If making a potion is like casting a charm, why don't I fall over from exhaustion after brewing a draught as powerful as boil curing?
The Friday before last, Harry's double potions class had brewed potions of boil curing, although even the most trivial healing charms, if you tried to cast them with wand and incantation, were at least fourth-year spells. And afterward, they'd all felt the way they usually felt after potions class, namely, not magically exhausted to any discernible degree. Harry had shut his copy of Magical Drafts and Potions with a snap, and rushed down to the Ravenclaw common room. Harry had found a seventh-year Ravenclaw doing his NEWT potions homework and paid the older boy a sickle to borrow most ponte potions for 5 minutes. Because Harry hadn't wanted to run all the way to the library to find confirmation. After skimming through 5 recipes in the seventh-year book, Harry had read the 6th recipe for a potion of fire-breathing which required ashwinder eggs, and the book warned that the resulting fire could be no hotter than the magical fire which had spawned the ashwinder which had laid the eggs. Harry had shouted, "Eureka!" right in the middle of the Ravenclaw common room, and been severely rebuked by a nearby prefect, who thought Mr. Potter was trying to cast a spell. Nobody in the wizarding world knew or cared about some ancient muggle named Archimedes, nor the physicist's realization that the water displaced from a bathtub would equal the volume of the object entering the bathtub. Conservation laws. There'd been the critical insight in more muggle discoveries than Harry could easily count. In muggle technology, you couldn't raise a feather 1 meter off the ground without the power coming from somewhere. If you looked at molten lava spilling from a volcano and asked where the heat came from, a physicist would tell you about radioactive heavy metals in the center of the Earth's molten core. If you asked where the energy to power the radioactivity came from, the physicist would point to an era before the Earth had formed, and a primordial supernova in the early days of the galaxy which had baked atomic nuclei heavier than the natural limit, the supernova compressing protons and neutrons into a tight, unstable package that yielded back some of the supernova's energy when it split. A light bulb was fueled by electricity, fueled by a nuclear power plant, fueled by a supernova. You could play the game all the way back to the Big Bang. Magic did not appear to work like this, to put it mildly. Magic's attitude towards laws like conservation of energy was somewhere between a giant extended middle finger and a shrug of total indifference. Aguamenti created water out of nothingness, so far as anyone knew. There was no known lake whose water level went down each time. That was a simple fifth-year spell, not considered impressive by wizards, because creating a mere glass of water didn't seem amazing to them. They didn't have the wacky notion that mass ought to be conserved, or that creating a gram of mass was somehow equivalent to creating 90 trillion joules of energy. There was an upper year spell Harry had run across whose literal incantation was Arresto Momentum, and when Harry had asked if the momentum went anywhere else, he'd just gotten a puzzled look. Harry had kept an increasingly desperate eye out for some kind of conservation principle in magic, anywhere whatsoever. And the whole time it had been right in front of him in every potions class. Potions making didn't create magic. It preserved magic. That was why every potion needed at least one magical ingredient. And by following instructions like stir four times counterclockwise and once clockwise, Harry hypothesized, you were doing something like casting a small spell that reshaped the magic in the ingredients, and unbound the physical form so that ingredients like porcupine quills dissolved smoothly into a drinkable liquid. Harry strongly suspected that a muggle following exactly the same recipe would end up with nothing but a spiny mess. That was what potions making really was. The art of transforming existing magical essences. So, you were a little tired after potions class, but not much, because you weren't empowering the potions yourself. You were just reshaping magic that was already there. And that was why a second-year witch could brew polyjuice, or at least get close. Harry had kept scanning through most potente potions, looking for something that might disprove his shiny new theory. After 5 minutes, he'd flipped the older boy another sickle, over his protests, and kept going. The potion of giant strength required a ream to trample the mashed dug bogs you stirred into the potion. It was odd, Harry had realized after a moment, because crushed dug bogs weren't strong themselves. They were just very, very crushed after the ream got through with them. Another recipe said to touch with forged bronze, i.e. grasp a knut in pliers so you could skim the potion's surface, and if you dropped the knut all the way in, the book warned, the potion would instantly superheat and boil over the cauldron. Harry had stared at the recipes and their warnings, forming a second and stranger hypothesis. Of course it wouldn't be as simple as potions making using magical potentials imbued in the ingredients, like muggle cars fueled by the combustion potential of gasoline. Magic would never be as sensible as that. And then Harry had gone to Professor Flitwick, since he didn't want to approach Professor Snape outside of class, and Harry had told Professor Flitwick that he wanted to invent a new potion, and he knew what the ingredients ought to be and what the potion should do, but he didn't know how to deduce the required stirring pattern. After Professor Flitwick had stopped screaming in horror and running in little circles, and Professor McGonagall had been called into the ensuing fierce interrogation to promise Harry that, in this case, it was both acceptable and important for him to reveal his underlying theory, it had developed that Harry had not made an original magical discovery, but rediscovered a law so ancient that nobody knew who had first formulated it. A potion spends that which is invested in the creation of its ingredients. The heat of goblin forges that had cast the bronze knut, the ream strength that had crushed the dug bogs, the magical fire that had spawned the ashwinder. All these potencies could be recalled, unlocked, and restructured by the spell-like process of stirring the ingredients in exact patterns. From a muggle standpoint, it was just odd. A deranged version of thermodynamics, invented by someone who thought life ought to be fair. From a muggle standpoint, the heat expended in forging the knut hadn't gone into the bronze, the heat had left and dissipated into the environment, becoming permanently less available. Energy was conserved, could be neither created nor destroyed. Entropy always increased. But wizards didn't think that way. From their perspective, if you'd put some amount of work into making a knut, it stood to reason that you could get exactly the same work back out. Harry had tried to explain why this sounded a bit odd if you'd been raised by Muggles, and Professor McGonagall had asked bemusedly why the Muggle perspective was any better than the wizarding one. The fundamental principle of potions-making had no name and no standard phrasing. Since then, you might be tempted to write it down, and someone who wasn't wise enough to figure out the principle themselves might read it, and they would start having all sorts of bright ideas for inventing new potions, and then they would be turned into catgirls. It had been made very clear to Harry that he wasn't going to be sharing this particular discovery with Neville or Hermione either after the next army's battle. Harry had tried to say something about Hermione seeming really off lately and this being just the sort of thing that might cheer her up. Professor McGonagall had said flatly that he wasn't even to think it, and Professor Flitwick had raised his little hands and made a gesture as of snapping a wand in half. Although the two professors had been kind enough to suggest that if Mr. Potter thought he knew what the potion's ingredients should be, he might be able to find an already existing recipe that did the same thing, and Professor Flitwick had mentioned several volumes in the Hogwarts library that might be useful. The vast, parchment-like screen now showed only an aerial view of the forest, from which you could barely make out the camouflaged forms of three armies, split up into two groups each, converging to fight their three-way battle. The benches of the Quidditch Stadium were now rapidly filling up with the more easily bored sort of spectator, who only wanted to be there for the final battle and skip out on all the boring points along the way. If there was anything wrong with Professor Quirrell's battles, it was widely agreed it was that his spectacles didn't last nearly as long as Quidditch matches once they actually started. To this, Professor Quirrell had replied only, "Such is realism." And that had been that. Within the huge window, it was all one window now, observing from a great height, the vague collections of tiny camouflaged forms grew closer. Closer, almost touching. The vast white parchment window showed the first touch of battle between sunshine and chaos, a screaming mass of running children with smiley faces upon their breasts, charging forward with contagio shields held high and others shouting, "Somnium!" Until one of their number shrieked,
"Prismatis!"
in a terrified voice, and the entire charge came to a sudden halt before the sparkling wall of force that had appeared in front of them. Tracy Davis had walked out from behind the trees.
"That's right," said Tracy, her voice low and grim as she levelled her wand on the barrier. "You should fear me, for I am Tracy Davis, the Dark Lady. That's Dark Lady spelt D-A-R-K-E, with an E."
Amelia Bones, director of the Department of Magical Law Enforcement, was sending an inquiring look at Mr. and Mrs. Davis, both of whom looked like they would have dearly preferred to die on the spot. Behind the prismatic barrier, there was some kind of hushed argument taking place among the Sunshine soldiers, one of whom in particular seemed to be getting scolded by several of the others. Then, a moment later, Tracy flinched. Susan Bones had come to the front of the Sunshine contingent.
"Goodness,"
said Augusta Longbottom.
"What do you suppose your grand niece has been learning at Hogwarts?"
"I don't know," Amelia Bones said calmly. "But I shall owl her a chocolate frog and instructions to learn more of it."
The prismatic barrier vanished. The sunshine soldiers resumed their charge forward. Tracy yelled, her voice high with strain.
"Inflammari!"
And the sunshine charge came to another sudden halt as a line of fire blazed up between them in the half-dry grass, extending to follow the path of Tracy's wand as she pointed it. An instant later, Susan Bones cried,
"Finite incantatum!"
And the flames dimmed, brightened, dimmed in the contest of their wills, other soldiers raising their wands to aim at Tracy, and that was when Neville Longbottom plunged shrieking out of the sky. One of the dragon warriors, Raymond Arnold, made a hand sign pointing forward and oblique left, and there was a sudden hushed hiss of whispers among the dragon army contingent as they all quietly reoriented themselves in the direction of the enemy. The Sunnies knew they were there, of course, both armies knew, but somehow, in this moment, they had all become instinctively quiet. The dragons crept forward further, and then further, the dull camouflaged forms of the Sunnies beginning to appear among the distant trees, and still nobody spoke. Nobody bellowed the call to charge. Draco was now at the forefront of his soldiers, Vincent behind him, and Padma only a shade further back. If the three of them could take the shock of Sunshine's best, the rest of Dragon Army might stand a chance. Then Draco saw one Sunny staring at him from the distance, in the vanguard of her own army, staring at him with a look of fury. Across the forest battleground, their eyes met. Draco had only a fraction of a second to wonder, in the back of his mind, what Hermione Granger was so angry about, before the shout went up from both their armies, and they were all running forward to the charge. The other chaotics had appeared now from among the trees. Some had dropped out of trees, and the battle was in full force now, everyone firing in every direction at anything that looked like an enemy, plus a number of Sunnies crying,
"Luminous!"
at Neville Longbottom as the Chaos Hufflepuff twisted and rocketed up through the air on courses that could only be described as, indeed, chaotic. And it happened, the way it happened only one time out of 20 in mock aerial combat, that Neville Longbottom's broomstick glowed bright red beneath his clenched hands. It should have meant that Longbottom was out of the game. Then, in the Hogwarts stands, among the watching crowds of students, a scream went up. "Combat realism!" It was Professor Quirrell's one master rule. You could get away with anything if it was realistic. And in real life, a soldier didn't just vanish when their broomstick got hit by a curse. Neville was falling toward the ground and screaming,
"A chaotic landing!"
And the chaotics were wrenching their attention away from fight to cast the hover charm and run at the same time so they wouldn't be sitting ducks, almost everyone else stopping to gape. And Neville Longbottom slammed into the leaf-laden forest ground, landing on one knee, one foot, and both hands as though he were kneeling down to be knighted. Everything stopped. Even Tracy and Susan paused in their duel. In the stadium, all crowd noises vanished. There was a universal silence composed of astonishment, concern, and sheer, dumbstruck, gaping awe as everyone waited to see what would happen next. And then Neville Longbottom slowly rose to his feet and levelled his wand at the Sunshine Soldiers. Though nobody on the battlefield heard it, a large segment of the stadium audience had begun chanting in steadily rising notes each time the word was uttered, "Doom, doom, 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 doom!" Because you just couldn't see that and not think it required musical accompaniment.
"The crowd is cheering your grandson," said Amelia Bones.
The old witch was favouring the screen with a measuring look.
"So they are,"
said Augusta Longbottom.
"Some, if I hear correctly, are cheering our blood for Neville, our souls for Neville."
"Quite,"
said Amelia, taking a sip from a teacup which had not been there moments earlier.
"It shows the lad has leadership potential."
"These cheers,"
continued Augusta, her voice taking on an even more stunned quality,
"seem to be coming from the Hufflepuff benches."
"It is the house of the loyal, my dear,"
said Amelia.
"Albus Percival Wulfric Brian Dumbledore, what in Merlin's name has been happening in this school?"
Lucius Malfoy was watching the screens with an ironic smile, his fingers tapping at his armrest in no discernible pattern.
"I do not know what is more frightening, the thought that he has some hidden plan behind all this, or the thought that he does not."
"Look!"
cried the Lord of Greengrass. The dapper young man had risen half out of his chair, pointing his finger at the screen.
"There she goes!"
"We'll both take him at once,"
Daphne whispered. She knew that a few fear-filled minutes of real combat experience, a handful of times each week, might not be enough to match Neville's regular dueling practice with Harry and Cedric Diggory over the same period.
"He's too much for one of us, but both of us together. I'll use my charm. You just try to stun him."
Hannah, beside her, nodded, and then they both screamed at the top of their lungs and charged forward, the hover charms of two supporting Sunshine Soldiers moving them faster and making them light on their feet. Daphne already crying, "Tenare!" even as Hannah kept a huge contagio shield moving in front of them, and with a brief extra lift they leapt over the heads of the front screen of soldiers and landed in front of Neville with their hair billowing high around them. Photographs were strictly prohibited at all Hogwarts games, but somehow this moment still ended up on the front page of the next day's Quibbler. And in the same instant, because fighting older bullies had burned away the slightest traces of hesitation, Hannah fired her first sleep hex at Neville. She'd started the incantation while she was still in the air, even as Daphne, concentrating more on speed than on force, slashed down with her ancient blade at where she thought Neville's thighs would be after he dodged. But Neville leapt up, not sideways. Leapt up higher than he should have been able to go, so that her glowing sword cut only the air beneath his feet. Somehow Daphne realized what it meant that Neville still had other chaotics hovering him, in time for her to raise her blade up over her head. But Neville fell too fast, and when his blade smashed into hers it was like being hit by a bludger. It knocked Daphne off her feet and sent her sprawling backward onto the grass, hitting the ground hard on her back. It might have been all over for her then, if Neville hadn't landed too hard himself and gone to his knees with a pained gasp. And then, before Neville could bring his glowing blade back down, Hannah shouted,
"Somnium!"
and Neville lurched frantically backward, though, of course, no spell had actually come from Hannah's wand. The Hufflepuff girl couldn't really have fired again that fast, which gave Daphne a second to scramble to her feet and get both hands around her wand again.
"Dear Merlin," said
Lady Greengrass. Her voice seemed unsteady, the aristocratic poise well punctured.
"My daughter is fighting with the charm of the most ancient blade in her first year. I never knew she possessed such extraordinary talent."
"Excellent blood," Charles Knott said approvingly, causing Augusta to snort. "My good lady," said Professor Quirrell, sounding grave, "do not wrong your daughter so. That is not mere talent which you see."
His voice grew a little drier.
"Rather, it is what happens when children put their competitive efforts into a game which involves actual spellcasting."
"Expelliarmus!"
shouted Draco, trying not to let his voice crack as he simultaneously dodged the blazing red stun bolt that Hermione Granger had fired at him, his muscles twisting with the need to dodge in the wrong direction. She had pointed to his left and then, with a mysterious twitch, fired right. Hermione dodged the fast-moving dueling hex and cried with hardly another moment's pause,
"Stellius!"
A wide angle hex that Draco couldn't avoid, but he managed to point his wand at his own face and cried,
"Quietus!"
before the sudden urge to inhale could devolve into a sneezing fit that would have ended the battle. Draco Malfoy was already half exhausted from all the locking charms and transfigurations earlier, but his confusion was beginning to give way to a sense of his own blood boiling. He didn't know why Granger was attacking him so angrily all of a sudden, but if she wanted a fight, he'd give her one. The dragons and sunnies weren't stopping to watch the duel of their generals. The dragons were too disciplined to stop and watch, and that meant the sunnies had to go on fighting too. But the gaping audience in the Hogwarts Quidditch stands were being distracted even from Neville and Daphne's spectacle, shifting their eyes to the duel of two generals as Malfoy and Granger fired hex after hex and jinx after jinx at each other, casting more rapidly than any other student in their year could have managed. The dragon general's trained dueling dance matched by the sunshine general's frantic energy, the combat between them beginning to resemble an adult duel as the two most magically powerful first years resorted to spells more exotic than usual sleep hex. Although, Draco was beginning to realize, when he and Harry and Professor Quirrell had dismissed Miss Granger as having as much intent to kill as a bowl of wet grapes, they'd never seen her angry. Daphne lashed out with her ancient blade, again not trying to hit hard but just moving the blade as fast as possible. At the same time, Hannah cried,
"Somnium!"
and Neville leapt back again, but it had been another bluff, and Hannah was moving in to fire a real spell almost point-blank. And Neville Longbottom did exactly what, he would explain afterward, Cedric Diggory had trained him to do if he was fighting Bellatrix Black, which was to spin around and kick Hannah really hard in the pit of her stomach. The Hufflepuff girl made a sad little sound, a gasping cry of pain, as she was knocked off her feet by the hard shoe sinking into her abdomen with the force of Neville's whole body behind it. For an instant, the battlefield stood still, everything halting except Hannah's falling form. Then, Neville's face turned to absolute dismay and he lowered his wand, the chaotic lieutenant starting instinctively toward his housemate as he reached for her with his other hand. Even as Hannah turned her fall into a roll and came out with her wand raised and shot him. A fractional second later, Daphne, who hadn't hesitated either, sank her most ancient blade squarely into Neville's back, causing the chaotic lieutenant's muscles to jerk convulsively with the stunning magic discharged into him even as Hannah's sleep hex took effect. And then the last scion of Longbottom was sprawled still on the ground with a look of total surprise frozen to his face.
"Today, Mr. Longbottom has learned a valuable lesson about his feelings of pity and remorse," said Professor Quirrell. "And chivalry," said Amelia, sipping her tea again.
"Are you all right?"
whispered Daphne as she stood protectively over where Hannah lay on the ground, clutching her stomach. The girl didn't give anything back in reply, except more retching sounds that sounded like Hannah was trying not to throw up while trying not to cry. Somehow, even though it might not have been good tactics, it would have been better if Hannah had been hexed outright than for other soldiers to be tied up protecting her. A number of sunnies seemed to be standing in front of Hannah with their wands clutched tightly, staring angrily at the chaotics. Someone had thrown up a prismatic barrier between the two groups, Daphne couldn't see who. And for some reason, the chaotics didn't seem to be pressing the attack. Even Tracy had completely dropped the grim look on her face and was shifting her weight nervously from one foot to the other, as though she was having trouble remembering which side she was on.
"Hold!"
shouted a voice.
"Hold the battle!"
There wasn't much battle going on anyway, but it held. General Potter, looking every inch the boy who lived, strode out from the trees with something large and camouflage cloth-covered held under one arm.
"Is Miss Abbott breathing all right?"
General Potter yelled. Daphne didn't look back. She didn't trust that this wasn't a trap. It was absolutely certain that if the chaotics took the opportunity to attack, Professor Quirrell would not only rule it legal, but also award them extra points afterward. But Daphne could hear the answer well enough with her ears. It wasn't like Hannah was trying to breathe quietly, and so she said,
"Sort of."
"She should just get out of here and to someone who can use healing charms,"
Harry said.
"Just in case that broke something."
From behind Daphne, a small, gasping voice said,
"I can still fight." "Miss Abbott, don't,"
Harry said, just as there was the sound from behind Daphne of someone collapsing back to the grass after trying and failing to get to her feet. Everyone winced, but Daphne didn't turn her back on Harry.
"Why haven't the teachers stopped the battle?"
said Susan, her voice angry.
"I expect it's because Miss Abbott is in no danger of permanent damage, and Professor Quirrell thinks we're learning valuable lessons,"
Harry said in a hard voice.
"Look, Miss Abbott, if you go, Tracy will also retire from the battle. You already outnumber us, so that's a very good deal for your side. Please take it."
"Hannah, just go," said Daphne. "I mean, just say you're out."
When Daphne glanced back, she saw that Hannah was shaking her head, still curled up in a ball on the grass.
"Oh, screw this," said Harry. "Chaotics! The faster we stun them, the faster she's out of here. We're going to do this very quickly, even if we take casualties. End truce! Tuna fish!"
Daphne's political hindbrain had only an instant to admire how Harry's few words had just made the chaotics the good guys. And then, in almost perfect unison, the chaotics were plunging their hands into the pockets of their uniforms and drawing out green sunglasses in an unfamiliar style. Not like anything you would wear to the beach, more like goggles for advanced potions. Then Daphne realized what was about to happen and snapped up her other hand to shield her eyes, just as Harry ripped the cloth off the cauldron. The fluid that spilled forth as Harry threw the cauldron's contents into the air was too bright to be seen, too brilliant to be imagined, incandescent like the sun magnified a dozen times. Which was exactly what it was. The sunlight which had been invested to create the acorns, the bright energy that had fueled a tree rising up from the bare dirt. Blazing a searing purple, the colour of the mixed blue and red wavelengths that chlorophyll absorbed, with almost none of the green wavelengths that chlorophyll reflected to create the green colour of leaves, which was the colour of the Chaos Legion's sunglasses, made to pass through green wavelengths, blocking red and blue, reducing even the most incandescent purple glare to something bearable. The violet light blazed on and on. Daphne tried dropping her arm from her eyes, but found that she couldn't look directly at anything. Even the second-hand purple glare was so bright she had to squint, and she only had time to cry one finite incantatum, which didn't work, before a sleep hex took her. What was left of the battle didn't take very long after that.
"Now!" bellowed Blaze Zabini, formerly of Sunshine, now commanding a detachment of Chaos Legionnaires. "I mean, tuna fish!"
The Slytherin boy's hand grasped the cloth shielding the cauldron from the triggering touch of daylight, already beginning to move it aside.
"No!"
bellowed Dean Thomas, formerly of Chaos, commanding a consignment of dragon warriors.
"Do whatever they do!"
The chaotics of Zabini's detachment plunged their hands into their uniform pockets and came forth bearing green sunglasses. An action almost perfectly mirrored by Dean and the dragon warriors, who drew forth green-coloured potions goggles and quickly drew the straps over their own heads, even as the chaotics put on their sunglasses and the violet incandescence blasted forth. As General Malfoy had explained, if Mr. Goyle reported that the Chaos Legion was wearing green-coloured potions goggles, you didn't have to know why to transfigure some copies.
"That's cheating!" shrieked Blaze Zabini.
"That's technique!"
Dean yelled back.
"Dragons, charge!"
"Pardon me," the Lady Greengrass said. "Could you stop laughing like that, Mr. Quirrell? It's unnerving."
"Finite their goggles!"
shouted Blaze Zabini as the two armies ran headlong toward each other through omnipresent, eye-searing purple glare.
"We can still win!"
"You heard him!"
bellowed Dean.
"Get their glasses!"
Blaze Zabini's reply to this wasn't anything articulate. The battle went on a lot longer.
"Stupefy!"
shrieked the Sunshine General. Draco didn't dodge. He didn't counter. He didn't have enough energy left for either. All he could do was whip his left hand into position and hope. The red stunbolt dissipated again on Draco's colloportus glove, which he'd transfigured and spell-locked to his hand the same as the rest of Dragon Army. It was all that was saving him now, that shield. It should have been a time to counterattack, but Draco could only catch his breath as the two of them danced backward and forward beneath the trees in the never-ending movements of their duel. Across from him, General Granger was panting hard, the young girl's face glistening with sweat like dew, her chestnut hair wetted into brown plaits. Her camouflage uniform was stained with damp spots, her shoulders visibly trembling with exhaustion, but her wand was still steel steady where it stayed level on Draco through all their motion. Her eyes glaring, her cheeks flushed with rage.
"So, little girl, why are you pretending to fight like a grown-up today?"
The taunt came to mind, but he didn't really think he needed Granger any angrier. So instead, Draco just said, though he could hear his own voice cracking,
"Any reason you're feeling mad at me, Granger?"
The girl was gasping for breath herself, her own voice wobbling as she spoke.
"I know what you're up to,"
said Hermione Granger, her voice rising.
"I know what you and Snape are up to, Malfoy, and I know who's behind it."
Draco said without even thinking about it. That only seemed to increase Granger's fury, and her fingers whitened on the wand she held leveled on him. And then Draco got it, and it boiled his own blood in his veins. Even she thought he was secretly plotting against her.
"You too?" Draco yelled. "I helped you, you buck-toothed bint! You...
Stuttering past all the dark curses that came to mind until he found something he could actually cast at her.
"Denswegio!"
But Granger flashed and whirled around the tooth-lengthening hex, and then her own wand came around and leveled at almost point-blank range, even as Draco brought up his left hand like a shield, placing the magic-locked glove between himself and whatever she was about to fire. And the Sunshine General's own voice rose to a shriek audible across the whole battleground.
"Hello, Hermora!"
Time should have paused, but it didn't. Instead, the padlock clicked and fell off the glove. Just like that. Just like that. The screens showed it all very clearly, to the entire watching Hogwarts stadium, and the bone-dead silent hush that fell over every bench in every bleacher said that everyone understood quite clearly what it meant. That the scion of House Malfoy had just had his magic overcome by a Muggle-born. Hermione Granger didn't pause in her fight, gave no sign that she even knew what she'd done. Instead, her foot snapped out in a Muggle-style kick that knocked Draco's wand clean out of his hand, his shocked mind and body moving just a little too slowly. Draco dove after his wand, scrabbling frantically on the ground, but from behind him a girl's cracking voice said,
"Thumnium!"
And Draco Malfoy fell and didn't rise again. There was another moment of frozen silence. The Sunshine General was wobbling on her feet, looking like she might faint. Then the dragon warriors screamed at the top of their lungs and charged forward to avenge their fallen commander. Mr. and Mrs. Davis were shaking as they stood up from the comfortable chairs of the faculty Quidditch box. They couldn't quite clutch each other while walking, but they held hands tightly, pretending hard to be invisible. If there'd been children young enough for accidental magic, they probably would have spontaneously disillusioned themselves. The elderly Charles Knott said nothing as he stood from his chair. The scarred Lord Jugson said nothing as he stood from his own chair. Lucius Malfoy said nothing as he stood. All three of them turned without pause and strode toward the stairwell of the elevated bleachers, moving in eerie unison like an aura trio.
"Lord Malfoy,"
the defense professor said in mild tones. That man was still seated in his own chair, looking upon his parchment-like screens, arms limp at his side, as though for some reason he didn't feel like moving. The white-haired man halted just before reaching the exit archway, and the elderly man and the scarred man halted as well, flanking him. Lord Malfoy's head turned, too slightly to be any form of acknowledgement, but in the defense professor's direction.
"Your son performed exceptionally well today," said Professor Quirrell. "I must confess that I underestimated him, and he has earned his army's loyalty, as you have witnessed."
Still very mild, the defense professor's voice.
"Speaking as your son's teacher, it is my opinion that he will not benefit if you interfere in his..."
Lord Malfoy and his compatriots vanished down the stairs.
"A fine try, Quirinus," Dumbledore said quietly.
The old wizard's face showed small lines of worry. He hadn't risen from his own seat either, staring at the parchment screens as though they were still active.
"Do you think he will listen?"
The defense professor's shoulders twitched in a slight shrug, the only movement they'd shown since the battle ended.
"Well,"
said the Lady Greengrass as she rose up and cracked her knuckles, stretching, her husband silent beside her.
"I must say, that was quite... interesting."
Amelia Bones had risen from her own cushioned seat without any fuss.
"Interesting indeed," said Director Bones. "I do confess, I find myself disturbed by the skill with which those children were fighting one another."
"The skill?" Lord Greengrass said. "Their spells didn't seem all that impressive to me, except for Daphne's, of course."
The old witch did not move her eyes from where she was gazing at the defense professor's balding head.
"The stunning hex is not a first-year spell, Lord Greengrass, but that is not the skill I had in mind. They supported each other with those simple spells. They reacted at speed to surprises."
The director of the DMLE paused as though searching for words that a mere civilian could understand.
"In the midst of battle," she said finally, "with spells flying in every direction, those children seemed quite at home."
"Indeed, Director Bones," said the defense professor. "Some arts are best begun in youth."
The old witch's eyes narrowed.
"You are readying them to become a military force, Professor. To what end?"
"Now hold on," interjected Lord Greengrass. "There's plenty of schools where they teach dueling in first year."
"Dueling?"
said the defense professor. From behind, it wasn't visible if the pale face was smiling.
"That is nothing, Lord Greengrass, to what my students have learned. They have learned not to hesitate in the face of ambushes and greater foes. They have learned to adapt when combat conditions change and change again. They have learned to protect their allies, to protect more those who are more valuable, to abandon pieces which cannot be rescued. They have learned that to survive, they must follow orders. Some have even learned a little creativity. No, no, Lord Greengrass. These wizards will not hide in their manners and wait to be protected when the next threat comes. They will know that they know how to fight."
Augusta Longbottom loudly clapped her hands together three times.
"We won,"
It was the first thing Draco heard when he woke up on the battlefield, Padma telling him how his soldiers had rallied after he fell. How, thanks to the Dragon General's foresight, Mr. Thomas had led his detachment to victory over Chaos. How General Potter had defeated the portion of the Sunshine Regiment that clashed with him. How Mr. Thomas's dragon warriors had rejoined the main body of soldiers bearing both their own goggles and the sunglasses of the defeated Chaotix. How, only moments later, General Potter's remaining contingent had attacked both other armies with a potion that emitted searing purple light. But Dragon had held the numerical advantage over Sunshine and Chaos both, and enough sunglasses for their warriors. And so Padma had managed to lead her inherited army to victory. From the light in Padma's eyes and her arrogant smile that would have done proud to a Malfoy, she was expecting congratulations. Draco managed to grit out some form of praise from between his clenched teeth and couldn't have said afterwards what it was. The foreign-born witch, it appeared, hadn't any idea what had happened or what it meant. The dragons trudged back to Hogwarts beneath grey skies, cold droplets landing heavy on Draco's skin one by one. While he'd been stunned, it had begun, the long-promised rain finally beginning to fall. There was only one option left to Draco now. A forced move, as Mr. McNair, who'd taught Draco chess, would have termed it. Harry Potter probably wouldn't like it, if he really was in love with Granger, the way everyone said. But the forced move, as Mr. McNair had defined it, was one you needed to make if you wanted the game to continue at all. It kept on playing in Draco's mind, over and over again, even as he walked like an automaton through the massive portals of Hogwarts, sent away Vincent and Gregory with two sharp words, and became alone within his private bedroom, sitting on his bed, staring at the wall above his desk, filling his mind like a Dementor had locked him into the memory. The padlock on his glove, clicking and falling away. Draco knew. He knew what he'd done wrong. He'd been so tired after casting 27 locking charms for all the other dragon warriors. Less than a minute wasn't enough time to recover after each spell. And so he'd just cast Colaportus on his own padlocked glove. Just cast the spell. Not put all his strength to bind it stronger than Harry Potter or Hermione Granger could undo. But nobody was going to believe that, even if it was true. Even in Slytherin, nobody would believe that. It sounded like an excuse, and an excuse was all that anyone would hear. Draco's mind kept playing it over and over as the resentment built. He'd helped Granger, cooperated with her on banning traitors, held her hand as she'd dangled off the roof, stopped a riot from breaking out around her in the Great Hall. Did she have any idea what he had risked, what he'd probably already lost? What it meant for the heir of House Malfoy to do that for a mudblood. And now there was only one move left. And the thing about a forced move was that you had to make it, even if it meant getting detention and losing house points. Professor Snape would know and understand, but there were limits. Father had warned him, to what the potions master would overlook. Challenge Granger to a wizard's duel in open defiance of Hogwarts regulations. Attack her outright if she tried to refuse. Defeat her one-on-one in public, not with clever dueling technique, but by overpowering her magic. Beat her solidly, completely. Crush her as utterly as the Dark Lord himself had crushed his enemies. Make it absolutely clear to everyone, so that nobody could possibly doubt that Draco had just been exhausted from casting the spell so many times. Prove that the Malfoy blood was stronger than any mudblood's. Harry Potter's voice whispered inside Draco's mind. Draco knew then. He knew the reason for the disquiet in the back of his mind, as he stared at the blank wall above his desk, contemplating his forced move. It should have been simple. When you only had one move, the thing to do was make it. But there'd been a part of him admiring that, before it had all gone wrong. Admiring Granger's fury and power. A part of him that had exulted in the first real fight he'd ever been in, against an equal opponent. If he challenged Granger and lost, it ought not to be possible. Draco had gotten his wand 2 full years before anyone else in his Hogwarts class. Only, there was a reason why they usually didn't bother giving wands to 9-year-olds. Age counted too. It wasn't just how long you'd held a wand. Granger's birthday had been only a few days into the year when Harry had bought her that pouch. That meant she was 12 now. That she'd been 12 almost since the start of Hogwarts. And the truth was, Draco hadn't been practicing much outside of class. Probably not nearly as much as Hermione Granger of Ravenclaw. Draco hadn't thought he needed any more practice to stay ahead. Whispered the voice of contrary evidence inside him. Granger must have been exhausted from all those stunning hexes, and even in that state, she'd been able to undo his locking charm. And Draco could not afford to challenge Granger publicly, one-on-one with no excuses, and lose. Draco knew what you were supposed to do in this sort of situation. You were supposed to cheat. But if anyone discovered Draco cheating, it would be disastrous. Perfect blackmail material, even if it never got out publicly, and any Slytherins watching would know that. They'd be looking. And then, if you were watching, you would have seen Draco get up from his bed and go to his desk and take out a sheet of the finest sheepskin parchment and a pearl carven inkwell, filled with greenish silver ink that had been made with true silver and crushed emeralds. From the great trunk at his bed's foot, the Slytherin drew forth a book bound also in silver and emeralds, entitled The Etiquette of the Houses of Britain. And, with a new, clean quill, Draco Malfoy began to write, frequently looking to the book where it lay open as reference. There was a grim smile on the boy's face, making the young Malfoy look very much like his father, as he carefully drew each letter as though it were a separate artwork. That form might have been meant to sound polite, long ago, when it had been invented. Nowadays, after centuries of being used to address mudbloods, it carried a lovely tinge of refined venom. Draco paused, carefully moving the quill aside so that it wouldn't drip. He needed a pretext for this, at least if he wanted to impose the duel's conditions. The challenged had the choice of terms unless they'd insulted a noble house. He needed to make it look like Granger had insulted him. What was he thinking? Granger had insulted him. Draco flipped the book to the page of standard formula, and found one that seemed appropriate. Draco had to stop and take a breath, forcing down the seething anger. He was starting to genuinely feel the insult now, and he'd just written out the last phrase and underlined it without thinking, like it was an ordinary letter. After a moment's reflection, he decided to let it stand. It might not be the exact formal phrasing, but it had a raw, angry tone that seemed appropriate. The 17th ruling of the 31st Wizengamot, Draco said aloud without looking, a line delivered in many plays. He sat straighter as he said it, feeling every pulse of the noble blood in his veins. If the duel went poorly, Draco could just say nothing and leave it at that. And if he defeated Granger, he would have learned experimentally that he could beat her again in a public challenge. It wasn't cheating, but it was science, which was almost as good. Where? Draco had been told about a room in Hogwarts that was good for jewels, where everything valuable was already protected by wards, and there were no portraits to tattle on you. Which one had it been again? And their second and public duel had better be soon, like tomorrow. It would take very little time for his reputation in Slytherin to go irretrievably to sludge. He needed to fight Granger for the first time tonight. Draco signed the formal parchment and then drew forth his ordinary and lesser parchment and his regular ink for his postscriptum. On the last letter, his quill pressed down on the parchment so viciously that the nib snapped off, creating a streak of ink and a small rip in the parchment, which Draco decided also looked appropriate. That night, at dinner time, Susan Bones came to Harry Potter and told him that she thought Draco Malfoy was going to carry out his plot against Hermione very soon. She was warning all the members of Spew, and she'd warned Professor Sprout, and she'd warned Professor Flitwick, and she was going to send a letter to her aunt tonight. And now she was warning Harry Potter too. Only they couldn't quite talk about it with Padma, Susan said, looking very serious, because Padma was feeling torn between her loyalty to Hermione and her loyalty to her general. Harry James Potter Evans Verus, who was at this point feeling more frustrated with the entire situation than anything really productive, snapped at her that, yes, he knew something had to be done. After Susan Bones left, Harry looked over at the other end of the Ravenclaw table, where Hermione had sat down away from him, or Padma, or Antony, or any of her other friends. But Hermione didn't look like she was in a mood where somebody going over and bothering her would be taken very well. Later, looking backward, Harry would think of how, in his sci-fi and fantasy novels, people always made their big, important choices for big, important reasons. Harry Seldon had created his foundation to rebuild the ashes of the Galactic Empire, not because he would look more important if he could be in charge of his own research group. Rasslyn Major had severed ties with his brother because he wanted to become a god, not because he was incompetent at personal relationships and unwilling to ask for advice on how to do better. Frodo Baggins had taken the ring because he was a hero who wanted to save Middle-earth, not because it would have been too awkward not to. If anyone ever wrote a true history of the world, not that anyone ever could or would, probably 97% of all the key moments of fate would turn out to be constructed of lies and tissue paper and trivial little thoughts that somebody could have just as easily thought differently. Harry James Potter Evans Verus looked at Hermione Granger, where she had sat down at the other end of the table, and felt a sense of reluctance to bother her when she looked like she was already in a bad mood. So then, Harry thought that it made more sense to talk to Draco Malfoy first, just so that he could absolutely, positively, definitely assure Hermione that Draco really wasn't plotting against her. And later on, after dinner, when Harry went down to the Slytherin basement and was told by Vincent that the boss ain't to be disturbed, then Harry thought that maybe he should see if Hermione would talk to him right away, that he should just get started on unravelling the whole mess before it ravelled any further. Harry wondered if he might just be procrastinating, if his mind had just found a clever excuse to put off something unenjoyable but necessary. He actually thought that. And then Harry James Potter Evans Verus decided that he'd just talk to Draco Malfoy the next morning instead, after Sunday breakfast, and then talk to Hermione. human beings did that sort of thing all the time. It was Sunday morning on the 5th of April 1992, and the simulated sky above the Great Hall of Hogwarts showed great torrents of rain pouring down in such density that the lightning flashes were diminished and scattered into small pulses of white light that sometimes transformed the house tables, paling their faces and making all the students appear briefly to be ghosts. Harry sat at the Ravenclaw table, wearily eating a waffle, waiting for Draco to make an appearance so that he could get started on sorting this whole thing out. There was a quibbler being passed around which had somehow ended up with Hannah and Daphne on the front page, but it hadn't gotten to his place yet. A few minutes later, Harry finished eating his waffle and then looked around again to see if Draco had arrived yet for breakfast at the Slytherin table. It was odd. Draco Malfoy was almost never late. Since Harry was looking in the direction of the Slytherin table, he didn't see Hermione Granger entering through the huge doors of the Great Hall. Thus, he was rather startled when he turned back and discovered Hermione sitting down directly beside him at the Ravenclaw table, just as if she hadn't not done that for more than a week.
"Hi, Harry,"
Hermione said, her voice sounding almost exactly normal. She started to put toast on her plate and a selection of healthy fruits and vegetables.
"How are you?"
"Within one standard deviation of my own peculiar little average," Harry automatically replied. "How are you doing? Did you sleep okay?"
There were dark bags under Hermione Granger's eyes.
"Why, yes, I'm fine," said Hermione Granger.
Harry said. He took a slice of pie onto his plate. As his brain was occupied with other things, Harry's hand simply took the tastiest thing within range, without evaluating complex concepts like whether he was ready to eat dessert.
Hermione, I'm going to need to talk to you later today. Is that okay?"
"Sure," said Hermione. "Why wouldn't it be?"
"Because," Harry said, "I mean, you and I haven't, for the last few days,"
suggested an internal part of Harry that seemed to have been recently allocated for governing Hermione-related issues. Hermione Granger didn't look like she was paying much attention to him in any case. She just stared down at her plate, and then, after about 10 seconds of awkward silence, began to eat her tomato slices, one after another, without pause. Harry looked away from her and began to eat a slice of pie which, he discovered, had somehow materialized on his plate.
"So,"
Hermione Granger suddenly said after she'd polished off most of her plate in silence,
"anything happening today?"
Harry said. He looked around frantically as though to find something happening that he could use as conversational fodder. And so, Harry was one of the first to see it, and wordlessly point, although the sudden swell of whispers that swept through the Great Hall showed that a number of other people had seen it too. The distinctive crimson tinge of the robes would have been recognizable anywhere, but it still took Harry's brain a few moments to place the faces. An Asianish-looking man, solemn and, today, looking rather grim. A man with a piercing gaze that swept over the room, his long black hair waving behind him in a ponytail. A man thin and pale and unshaven, with a face so blank that it was like stone. It took Harry a few moments to place the faces, and remember the names, from that long-ago day in January when the Dementor had come to Hogwarts. Commodo Butinaro, Gorionov.
"An aura trio?"
Hermione said in a strange, bright voice.
"Why,
I wonder what they'd be doing here.
Dumbledore was in their company as well, looking as worried as Harry had ever seen him. And after a moment's pause, while the old wizard's eyes scanned the great hall and the students whispering over their breakfasts, he pointed straight at Harry.
"Oh, now what?"
Harry said under his breath. His inward thoughts were a lot more panicked than that, as he wondered frantically if anyone had connected him to the Azkaban breakout somehow. He looked at the head table, trying to make the glance casual, and realized that Professor Quirrell was nowhere to be seen this morning. The auras swept toward him with swift strides, Aura Gorionov approaching from the other side of the Ravenclaw table as though to block any escape in that direction. Aura Komodo and Aura Butnaro approaching from Harry's side, the headmaster following straight on Komodo's heels. All conversation everywhere had ground to utter silence. The auras reached Harry's place at the table, surrounding him from three angles.
"Yes?"
Harry said as normally as he could.
"What is it?"
"Hermione Granger,"
Aura Komodo said in a toneless voice.
"You are under arrest for the attempted murder of Draco Malfoy."
Chapter 79 Taboo Trade-Offs, Part 1
"Hermione Granger,"
Aura Komodo said in a toneless voice,
"you are under arrest for the attempted murder of Draco Malfoy."
The words dropped into Harry's consciousness and shattered his thoughts into 100 shards of incredulity, the shock of adrenaline running into so much confusion that...
"She..."
Harry said.
"She... she wouldn't... what?"
The auras weren't paying any attention to him. Komodo spoke again, still in that colourless voice.
"Mr. Malfoy has regained consciousness in St. Mungo's and named you, Hermione Granger, as his assaulter. He has repeated these accusations under 2 drops of Veritas Serum. The blood-cooling charm you cast upon Mr. Malfoy would have killed him if he had not been found and treated, and it must be presumed known to you that this was a fatal curse. I therefore arrest you upon the serious charge of attempted murder, and you will be taken into ministry custody to be interrogated under 3 drops of Veritas Serum."
"Are you mad?"
The words burst out of Harry's mouth as he shoved himself up from the Ravenclaw table, an instant before Aura Butnaro's hand clamped down hard upon his shoulder. Harry ignored it.
"That's Hermione Granger you're trying to arrest. The nicest girl in Ravenclaw. She helps Hufflepuffs with their homework. She'd die before she tried to kill anyone."
Hermione Granger's face had crumpled.
"I did it,"
she whispered in a tiny voice.
"It was me."
Another huge rock fell on Harry's thoughts and crushed their fragile order, bursting fragments of comprehension into dust. Dumbledore's face seemed to have aged decades over the course of seconds.
"Why, Miss Granger?"
Dumbledore said, his own voice barely above a whisper.
"Why would you do such a thing?"
"I'm..."
Hermione said.
I'm sorry. I don't know why I..."
she seemed to collapse in on herself. Her voice was formed of nothing but sobs, and the only words that could be made out were,
"I thought I killed him. Sorry."
And Harry should have said something. Should have done something. Should have jumped up out of his seat and stunned all three auras and then gone on to some incredibly clever next move. But the twice shattered fragments of his thought processes could yield no output. Butinaro's hand pushed Harry gently but firmly back into his seat, and Harry found himself stuck there like he'd been glued. He tried to grab his wand for a finite, and it wouldn't come out of his pocket. The three auras and Dumbledore escorted Hermione out of the Great Hall amid a rising storm of outcries, and the doors began to swing shut behind them. Nothing made sense. It was surreal, beyond all reckoning, like he had been transported into an alternate universe. And then Harry's mind flashed back to another day of confusion, and in a moment of desperate inspiration he finally realized what the Weasley twins had done to Rita Skeeter, and his voice rose in a scream,
"Hermione! You didn't do it! You've been false memory charmed!"
But the doors had already shut. Minerva couldn't possibly have stood still. She paced back and forth through the headmaster's office, the back of her mind half expecting Severus or Harry to tell her to shut up and sit down, but neither the potions master or the boy who lived seemed much concerned with her.